the righteous deeds that you live out, the way that you live your life, the way that you raise your kids, it has far greater impact than you or I could ever imagine. There are many things that people may do in life, or they may think small of their own life as though their life was inconsequential. They had little impact on the world, little impact for the future. That is simply not true. The actions that we take in this life, they will reverberate throughout eternity. I remember, I'll give you two stories here. My own conversion experience. I grew up in church, and I was taught about Jesus and how he gave his life for me. As taught from as long as I can remember, even before I could understand, I was taught that. My dad being a pastor, but I remember when the gospel really, really hit me hard, when I really understood. And it wasn't in the middle of one of my dad's sermons. It was actually in my third grade Sunday school class. A woman who, I won't mention her name here, but a woman who was a postal worker. She worked for the U.S. Postal Service for, I guess, all of her career. Maybe at this point she's retired. But she taught the third grade Sunday school class. And she just faithfully showed up week in and week out. And she taught us. She put up with me. I've not always been as calm as I am now. My sons bear witness to this fact. But she endured me. And she didn't just put up with me. She shared the gospel with me. And it was through her righteous, faithful actions that the Lord really took the gospel and made it to make me aware of my sin. I remember laying in my bed one night, recalling the works of Jesus and the things of God, and the Holy Spirit changed my heart. The Holy Spirit called me to confess my sin to the Lord. I got out of my bed, kneeled down on the ground there, and called out to the Lord. And the Bible tells me, whosoever calls on the name of the Lord, they shall be saved. And I was born again that night. She may have not thought much about her teaching Sunday school, teaching the third grade Sunday school class, but now her actions seem very, very worthwhile because God is able to use her ministry to now minister to many hundreds of people, maybe many thousands of people over my lifetime, just because of the righteous actions of a faithful woman. God did exceedingly greater than anything that she could have imagined there. I recall the testimony of my grandfather. His daddy died when he was 9 years old. And Paw, Neil Rogers, he became the man of his house at 9 years old. And he signed up and went into the Merchant Marines. When he was 15, he lied to the U.S. government so that he could get a job and go fight for his country. And he signed up as a merchant marine when he was 15. And he was not the godliest of young men, I don't think. But the Lord got a hold of him during those years, and God called him out of sin and into righteousness. And Paw ended up taking a woman from Mississippi, my nanny, taking her as his wife and leading her in a godly way, raising three children in a godly home. He served as a deacon in a Baptist church. And from his righteous actions, from the righteous actions of a faithful man, maybe not seem much at that point, but even now, just two generations after that fact, from his lineage, he's already raised up another faithful Southern Baptist deacon and four faithful preachers. The righteous actions of faithful people. I want to show you tonight from this text that God uses the righteous actions of faithful people to bring to pass greater things than they could ever imagine. I don't want anybody in here to discount their life as though it were inconsequential or would have no impact in the future or in eternity. Everybody's actions echo in eternity, but God uses, mark this down, God uses the righteous actions of faithful people to bring to pass greater things than they could ever imagine. You remember Ruth the Moabite. She comes from a cursed land, from a cursed people, a pagan people. She has come into the nation of Israel, into the town of Bethlehem to serve her mother-in-law. Her husband, her brother-in-law, and her father-in-law have all died in the land of Moab. And now this young woman comes back to Naomi, her mother-in-law's hometown, Bethlehem. They come into Bethlehem. They are as poor as it gets, as destitute as it gets. And Ruth commits her life to serving her mother-in-law. She does the righteous thing. She shows steadfast love to her mother-in-law, though it seems that there is nothing for her to be gained. She ends up going out into a field of a man named Boaz, and she gleans among the wheat there. And Boaz shows her steadfast and faithful love, the love of the Lord. And he blesses her, and he blesses Naomi greatly. Boaz is a very godly man, and Ruth comes home, and she tells Naomi everything that had happened and how she had gone to Boaz's field, and Naomi makes her aware that Boaz is a member of their family. He is a relative of Naomi's husband, Elimelech, and Boaz is actually qualified, according to Deuteronomy 25, the principle of the law known as levirate marriage. Boaz is qualified to take Ruth as his wife. He would be known as a kinsman redeemer. He has the qualifications to take her as his wife and to produce an heir, not for himself immediately, but the first son born to he and to Ruth would be the heir of Mahlon. Mahlon was the deceased husband of Ruth. And in this way, through a kinsman redeemer, through a levirate marriage, God was able to provide an heir in every single house in Israel so that the inheritance would pass down generation after generation, because the gifts that the Lord gives are irrevocable. They are permanent. And so this is the way that God would perpetuate the name of those who had died before they could bear a child. And so Naomi says, Boaz is a kinsman redeemer. He's able to fix these things. He's able to bring life even to a dead situation. He's able to come in here and to redeem us and to save us and to take you, Ruth, as his wife. And so Naomi gives Ruth advice, and she says, you just go and you wait, because Boaz is threshing out the grain. He's been working all day. It's the end of the barley harvest. You go down to him at the threshing floor, and when he finishes his work, he's had his dinner and his drink for the night, and he goes to rest. You just see the place that he lays. And so when he lays down and goes to sleep, everybody else is asleep. Ruth goes to Boaz in the middle of the night, about midnight, and she lays herself down at Boaz's feet. And Boaz wakes up, and the text says, behold, there's a woman at his feet. That'd surprise any of us, wouldn't it? And here's Ruth at his feet, and he is shocked, he's surprised, and Ruth tells him what she's after. She says, you're a redeemer. And I've come to take refuge under your wings. She's come to him humbly. She's not presuming anything. She's not assuming anything from him. And Boaz says, tomorrow, Ruth, I'm going to take care of this matter. But I'm going to do it the right way. In broad daylight, in front of everybody, I'm going to go, because there's a relative who's closer than Boaz. He's going to go and he's going to confront that relative and see if he would like to take his right of redemption. He was going to do it in broad daylight because Boaz is a righteous man. He's a man of integrity. You see that even in the little things that Boaz does. So that's why our text picks up here in chapter 4, verse 1. Now it says in verse 1, now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. You see, Boaz wastes no time in doing what he said. We ought to make good on our word. When we say we're going to do something, we ought to make good on our word. And we ought to make good on our word as quickly as possible. Boaz told Ruth the night before, and when the morning comes, what does Boaz do? He goes to do the right thing. You know, the Bible tells us in James chapter 4, verse 17, "So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin." If you know the right thing to do, you ought to do it. And if you don't do the right thing, you don't get to say, "Well, I didn't do anything, therefore I'm off the hook." No, you are on the hook. We're called to do righteousness. We're not called just to acknowledge righteousness. We're called to do it. Boaz knew the right thing, so he gets up in the morning, and he has already gone to the gate of the city where the elders of that city would have gathered. And he's going to go there, and he's going to make good on his promise. Now, Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. Verse 2 says, "And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, 'Sit down here.' So they sat down." So you see what Boaz is doing. He is gathering up witnesses for this transaction, this discussion that is going to take place. One of the ways that you know that Boaz is a man of integrity is this, that Boaz is not afraid to do his business in broad daylight. See, righteous deeds have no need to fear public attention. Righteous deeds have no need to fear public attention. Boaz is going to do this in the broad daylight, in the morning, in front of the presence of many witnesses. In fact, it says even all the people. So here comes this other man who is a closer relative to Elimelech. He has the right to marry Ruth if he would like to. It says here in verse 3, let's read verse 3 through 4. "Then he said to the Redeemer, 'Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you.' And he said, 'I will redeem it.'" So Boaz, right here in the presence of all these witnesses, makes this other man, he's never named, I would assume, because his actions here in part come across as a bit shameful. So maybe he goes nameless for that reason, I'm not sure, but he's not given a name, he's just the Redeemer is what he's known as. So Boaz calls him out and says, "Come, sit here in front of the presence of all of these witnesses." And he tells them, he says, "Naomi, your relative, the deceased, or the wife of the deceased, our relative Elimelech, she's selling a plot of land. And you have the right to redeem it." Leviticus chapter 25 tells you about the right of redemption and how all of these laws would work out. And essentially, this is the way that it would happen. The people in Israel were given an inheritance. That inheritance was perpetual. It stayed within the family throughout eternity. As long as the earth lives, as long as the earth twirls on its axis, the inheritance stays in that family. But when a person became poor in Israel, what they were able to do was to take a plot of land that they owned, that they had inherited, and they were able to say, "Here is a plot of land. Now, my closest relatives, you have first dibs. You can buy this land from me for a fair price. And in that way, I am able to take care of my family during this time of poverty." Now, the inheritance would stay within the family forever. And so the back end of that law said this, that every 49 years, they had a celebration or a year called the Year of Jubilee. Those who had sold themselves into indentured servitude, or those who had sold land to take care of their poverty, in the year of Jubilee, that 50th year, after every 49 years, all of the land, all of the people would be set free, and they would go back to the original owners. And so when this man was offered this land to buy it, the way that they would buy it is they would number the years until the year of Jubilee. If it was 10 years away, then that field was worth 10 years of crops. And so to buy that field, they would pay the price of 10 years of crops. Okay, so you see how this works. But then after that 10 years, or after 49 years, that land would go back to the family. So you can see why this Redeemer, the man who goes the name, you can see why he would be excited about this. Here he is getting the opportunity to buy a cheap piece of land in which he can grow crops and make himself a little more wealthy than he already is. It's not a permanent obligation, though. It's a very temporary obligation. Maybe he's got 20 years until Jubilee, maybe 10, maybe 40, but it's a very temporary, very non-permanent type of purchase. And so what does he say? He says, hey, I'll redeem it. You see, the man is okay. Please understand that. That's the reason I explained all of that. Understand that this man is okay. He's okay with doing something that only has temporary consequences. So he's going to jump all over this opportunity. But notice what happens here in verse 5 through 6 that is very interesting. Verse 5, Boaz said, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, the temporary piece of property, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth. She's not temporary. You marry this woman, you are married till death do you part. That is a permanent commitment. The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite. She's from a cursed people. You acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. If you marry Ruth, you buy this field, you marry Ruth, and it's your responsibility to raise up an heir for Mahlon, her deceased husband. So if you want the temporary, you're going to have to make the commitment to the permanent here. In order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. Look at verse 6. Then the Redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair or ruin my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. You see, this man, this Redeemer, he's willing to commit to the temporary, isn't he? Very unwilling to commit to the permanent. He's okay with receiving the blessing of the field, because that's going to make him wealth, but he doesn't want to have attached to it any type of responsibility, any type of permanent responsibility. He has an obligation as a redeemer to raise up an offspring for his deceased relative Mahlon, but he's unwilling to do it. He's much like a character in the Bible, a historical character that is, in Genesis chapter 38. Judah had a son who had a wife, and her name was Tamar, and she was childless, and her husband died because he was wicked. There was a man by the name of Onan who came along, and he was also the son of Judah, and it was his obligation to raise up an heir for his brother. Onan took Tamar as his wife, and he began to sleep with her time and again, but he would always interrupt the process so he wouldn't be able to make an heir. He's okay with the pleasure of it, but he's not okay with the obligation of a child. Because he feels like if he has a child with Tamar, it's going to ruin his own inheritance. Now he's got to divvy things up between a bunch of different kids, and he doesn't want to make his own kids a little less wealthy. He doesn't want to ruin his own inheritance. So Onan is a very greedy, unrighteous man. So you know what God does to him? God kills him. God kills him because of his greed, because of his covetousness, because he's unwilling to do the righteous thing, because he's okay fulfilling his temporary lusts, but he's not okay taking the permanent obligation. It is the epitome of lustful, unrighteous actions for a man or a woman to engage in intercourse and not be willing to make the permanent commitment. It is the epitome of lust and unrighteous actions for a man or a woman to engage in intercourse and not be committed to the permanent consequences and to be married till death do they part. It's unrighteous in the eyes of God. It is not pleasing in the eyes of God. It's not just called dating. It's not like it has no consequences. It has permanent consequences. And in fact, God killed Onan because he was okay with the pleasure, but he's not okay with the responsibility. If we want to engage in those actions, the actions that God himself has created and called good, we need to be ready to make the commitment forever to that person in particular, to that single person, till death do us part. This Redeemer who goes nameless, he's unwilling to do that. He's okay with pleasure, just not okay with responsibility. You know what he does, though? Because he's unwilling to take the responsibility, he actually forfeits the blessing of being in the lineage of the King of Kings that would be born to David. He forfeits the blessing because he's not okay with committing to the permanent. You know, I think many people would be okay. They'd really love to be blessed if it didn't require commitment. They'd really love to be blessed if it didn't require sacrifice. They'd love to enjoy the blessings of marriage, just not the marriage. I think many people would love heaven if it didn't cost them their life. And many people would love to follow Jesus if it wasn't going to require them to die on a cross, to die to self, to die to this world. Many people love heaven if it didn't cost them their life. This man seems to be okay. He's okay with the temporary, just not with the permanent. And maybe Boaz knew that. Maybe that's why he does this the way that he does. Look at verse 7 through 10. You see how this deal goes down. Now, this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders of the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Also, Ruth the Moabite," you can imagine he said this with joy, "also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife to perpetuate," he's okay with the permanent, isn't he? "To perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." It's an interesting way that this business deal took place. This is before contracts were written out on a Word document or on a piece of parchment. What they did was they gathered a bunch of witnesses, the elders of the city, the men who were to be honest, and they would conduct their business in the presence of many witnesses. And when a man would sell a piece of property or he'd give his right to something over, he takes off his sandal and he gives it to that other person. I truly think that this symbolizes this figurative thought. Everywhere that my shoe has the right to tread, I surrender that to you. And this is a symbol of it in the presence of all these people. The places that I would have had the right to walk, I give that up. And I give it over to you. It's in your hands now to do just as you please. This seemed to please the elders of the city and all the people. Look at verse 11. Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses." Look at these blessings. "May the Lord," that's his covenant name, Yahweh, "may the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house, this pagan woman from Moab, who has converted herself to follow after Jehovah, to follow after Yahweh. This woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel." Rachel and Leah, both the daughters of that wicked man named Laban. Both of these women were manipulatively given over to Jacob, whose name was later changed to Israel. To Jacob, Rachel and Leah together bore 12 sons to him. These are the 12 sons whom we know that perpetuated the 12 tribes of Israel. There was a great many blessings that flowed through this line here. So that's what the people of the city say. "Boaz, now that you're taking Ruth as your wife, may the Lord bless her and bless you in the same way that he blessed Jacob and his wife," or Israel, "and the 12 sons of Israel, Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily of Ephrathah," that's another name for Bethlehem, May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem, and may your house be like the house of Perez, whom bore Tamar, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this woman." Look at verse 13. "So Boaz took Ruth. She became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son." I find that staggeringly humbling. I find that very humbling. When we think about mankind, when we think about the things that a man can do, sure, we've put people on the moon, we've put people on Mars, we traversed to these various galaxies, we've flown faster than the speed of sound, invented computers, all sorts of medical advances. But you know what the one single greatest act, the most astounding act that mankind can do, is actually produce another life? That's something that doctors cannot do, scientists cannot do, but man can do that. Man can perpetuate life. But notice this, that even in the greatest act that mankind can commit, God's the one who gives the victory. God is the one who accomplishes it. Look at what it says in verse 13. "And the Lord gave her conception." The Lord is the one who gives life. Any of us who have children, any who desire children, ought to be very cognizant of that fact, ought to be very humbled by that fact. That's the Lord who gives life. I quoted that verse for you just a little while ago in that prayer. It says in the book of John, in John chapter 1, about Jesus, "In him was life, and the life was the light of men." We ought to thank God that we're alive. We ought to thank God for the lives of our children. The Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. It gets even better. "Then the women said to Naomi, 'Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel.'" What a change of circumstances for Naomi. You remember when she came into Bethlehem? She is ragged from the journey from Moab there to the house of bread to Bethlehem. She and Ruth walking on foot all that way, it seemed. They're poor. They're without home. They're without help. They're hopeless. They have been to a bunch of funerals, and it's just very depressing. And Ruth and Naomi come into town. Naomi, the widow, lost all her sons just as well, and she's accompanied by a cursed woman from Moab. And when she comes into town, she's been gone for a decade, and the women of the city look at her and say, "Is this Naomi? You went away married and with two sons. You went away blessed of God, and you come back now not only cursed of God, you have a cursed woman with you. Is this Naomi?" And what does Naomi say? "No longer call me Naomi," which means pleasant, "but call me Mara," which means bitterness, "because the Lord has dealt very bitterly with me." And Naomi points out that God has acted very sovereignly in her life. And even in that, she gives glory to the Lord. But the women of the town seem eager to ridicule her. Is this really Naomi? But look at what they say now. They're not laughing anymore, are they? They say, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel." Verse 15, "He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap. That word literally means bosom or lap. She holds this child close to her chest. You can imagine she really appreciates life at this point, after having her husband and her two sons die. Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. Here's Naomi in her old age. She had been at a place of darkness where everything had been taken from her, and now she is holding a brand new baby boy because her daughter-in-law had been redeemed. And so her life also has been redeemed. Ruth has done nothing from day one but serve her mother-in-law. She has acted selflessly. She's gotten up in the morning, worked all day long till the evening, brought food home to her mother-in-law, got up the next day, and did it again. She has done nothing but serve Naomi, which ought to tell us something about Naomi's age. She's probably very old at this point. Earlier she said there's no way she's going to be able to have another child. And even if she did, there's no way that child will grow up in time to give her an heir. Here she is, an old woman, unable to help herself, but you know what she can do? She can hold the baby. She can minister now. And the only way she can minister to Ruth. You know, it's quite a blessing, just as a side note, it's quite a blessing to a young family for somebody to come along sometimes and just hold the baby, please. You know what I mean? So here's Naomi. She holds this little baby. Now she's actually able to serve. She follows the example here of Ruth. A lot of serving going on, which makes us very aware of why this child is named what he is named. Verse 17 says, "And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, 'A son has been born to Naomi.' They named him Obed." They named him Obed. You know, Obed is a very interesting name, but when you think about the life of Ruth, you understand. Obed simply means servant. That's not a demeaning title at all. In fact, that's a badge of honor. Because his mama, she served till she had calluses on her hand. His grandma served and held him as a baby. It's no wonder why he's named Obed. And even the women of the city, they now have recognized this is not just Ruth the Moabite. Ruth is a servant. Ruth is a righteous woman. She is a faithful woman. They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Look at verse 18. "Now these are the generations of Perez." You don't know who Perez is, maybe, unless you've been reading the Old Testament. Perez was one of the sons of Judah. In fact, he was the son whom Judah and Tamar bore. Perez carries on the name of Judah. If you remember back there in Genesis chapter Genesis 49, Jacob's father blesses Judah. And Jacob looks at Judah there in his old age as his eyes are going dim. And it says here that Jacob says to Judah in Genesis 49, verse 10, he says, "The scepter," that's the staff of being a ruler, "the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of all the peoples." Verse 11 gets even better. "Binding his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine, he washed his garments in wine and his vesture in the blood of grapes." Who's that speaking of? That is speaking of Jesus, who came down there from the Mount of Olives riding on the foal of a donkey, just as it says in Genesis 49, comes riding down on the foal of a donkey into Jerusalem. And in a matter of days after entering into Jerusalem, being exalted, "Hosanna in the highest, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." Jesus lays down his life on the cross of Calvary, washing his people in his blood, his vesture in the blood of grapes, as Judah said there, or as Jacob said to Judah. "Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. And Nahshon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David." That's very interesting, isn't it? Here's this poor Moabite woman, and a simple farmer. And their great-grandson was the greatest king that Israel ever knew until the Lord Jesus steps on the stage. It's interesting that the righteous deeds of a Moabite woman to care selflessly for her mother-in-law would put her in the line of King David. Moreover, to King David was also born Jesus, the King of Kings, the King of Ages. It's astounding even to think, moreover, of this, that Boaz, the righteous actions of a man named Boaz to redeem a poor woman who was coming from a foreign country, actually would set him in the line of the Son of God. I want everybody to understand this tonight. God's plan in your life is always bigger than you. Your plan, God's plan in your life is always bigger than you. The righteous deeds that you live out, the way that you live your life, the way that you raise your kids, it has far greater impact than you or I could ever imagine. You know, this is a beautiful foreshadowing of the work of Jesus when he came into the world. It's a very beautiful picture. Here you have a man from Bethlehem, a righteous man from the city of Bethlehem, living a righteous life, redeeming a woman from a pagan land. And through that redemption, he bears a son of righteousness. He bears many righteous people. Such is also the picture there of Jesus. Where was Jesus born? Born in the city of Bethlehem. Jesus born in humility, born humble, because there wasn't even room in the local inn. No room in the hotel for Jesus and his family. So he's born there in a barn, a man of Bethlehem who didn't just live a righteous life, he lived a perfectly righteous life. And Jesus takes people all over the world, people like you and I, unrighteous people, people who come from a cursed land, and he takes us into his house, into refuge, and he redeems us from our sins, redeems us from death, and he gives us everlasting life. It's a very beautiful picture of what Jesus has done for us. You know, you wouldn't think it when you read this, book, you would think, well, why am I being told about a woman who serves her mother-in-law? Why am I being told about a farmer who redeems this woman? I think it very much has to do with this, so that we would learn this lesson, that God uses the righteous actions of faithful people to bring to pass greater things than they could ever imagine. Don't discount the importance of righteous deeds. Well, Boaz, I'm sure glad that he didn't discount that opportunity for righteousness when he saw Ruth come into his field to just get a little bit of grain. No, he comes into the field and he shows kindness to her. He shows steadfast love to her. I'm thankful that Ruth didn't betray the opportunity to serve her mother-in-law, Naomi. She stayed right there by her. And through the righteous actions of these faithful people, God accomplished far more than they could have ever have thought. Would you pray with me?